Welcome to the Raising Resilience podcast by AceAwareNL. AceAwareNL is the Dutch platform that ties in with an international movement for more awareness around ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. If you are listening now, your own childhood may seem over. But is it? How did that period color your view of the world? How resilient did you become? Resilience is not innate, but has to develop. In ourselves and each other, we can both raise and lower resilience. What can we do as a society to help children become resilient? What do they need for a happy and relaxed start in life? And what do parents and other adults need to lovingly support children through that process? And how can we deal with grief and trauma in a healing way? These questions will be inquired by AceAwareNL in this podcast. Together with you, we will discover what keeps us healthy, happy, and energetic as humans, and we gladly offer you a stage for your story. Share your knowledge and experience as a professional or experience expert with our listeners, and together we will be raising resilience. Enjoy listening. Today, I am in Amsterdam with Dr. Niels Bergman after having toured through Belgium together for several presentations he gave. As always, it was a pleasure again to hear him speak, and because of the importance of his work, I feel honored and blessed that he accepted my invitation to share his view on resilience with the listeners of my podcast. As a lactation consultant, your goal is to support mothers and babies in getting the breastfeeding relationship going. On the one hand, the wishes of the parents are leading in our guidance, and at the same time, we are advocates for the baby who cannot speak for themselves. In that role, we have responsibility to explain to parents why certain approaches make more sense than others for the health of mother and baby. Sometimes this new information can feel confusing or overwhelming for parents. One aspect of this information is to try and make sure that baby is exclusively breastfed from the beginning, without any supplementation with formula, even if the baby is very small. This is the way to optimally foster healthy development of baby's immune system and all other systems. There is one group of babies for whom this is crucially important, and those are the ones who are born prematurely and sometimes extremely prematurely, at only 24 or 25 weeks gestation instead of the average 40 weeks. I cannot remember exactly when I heard first of the work that Dr. Niels Bergman was doing in this field and how he transformed the concept of kangaroo care to kangaroo mother care, emphasizing the need for the tiniest babies to be placed on mother's body not for an hour per day or so, but constantly. As Niels always passionately calls it, zero separation. Over the years, it became more and more clear how scientifically grounded his work is. And together with his wife Jill, he made remarkable progress in the care for prematurely born babies while he worked in Zimbabwe and Cape Town. It led to a book that I felt should also be available for the Dutch field. After meeting in Durham for a conference, we made agreements about me turning the book Hold Your Pram into a Dutch version, and that was an amazing journey. Both working with Niels and Jill and doing photo shoots of moms with their tiny little ones was very impressive. Hearing the often heartbreaking stories of loss and worry, and also the deep gratitude and wonder when babies make it through those first hard months, made me more aware than I already was of how big this miracle of life is and how crucial it is to have professionals who put their heart and soul into optimal care. Niels Bergman is such a professional, as well as a dad and a granddad, and it is a joy to sit with him today to speak about a healthy start. Welcome, Niels, to the AceAwareNL podcast, Raising Resilience.
Thank you, and for your kind words also.
Yeah, you really deserved them, because it was amazing again to see all the evidence that you have gathered over the years. And We've spoken a lot these last 2 days about the different steps and how it all came about. You want to share something about that?
Perhaps. Well, I started this journey 1988. In a remote hospital in Zimbabwe without technology. So it wasn't difficult. We had heard, there were seven published papers, five or six or seven. We weren't restricted by any rules. And so there was no incubator. So we skipped that part and we put the babies skin to skin immediately after birth. So it began with an observation triggered by circumstances. A 1,000 grand baby that was being taken away by the nurses because that's what they did normally. We stopped them, put the baby skin to skin, and that baby survived. It didn't just survive. It really behaved differently. And it felt different. It had a warmer, drier skin. Its head was round when it went home. But the baby opened his eyes. And this eye-opening, maybe it's a very small event, but it triggered certainly this matters. That is a small human being, and we were taking it to the sluice room.
The sluice room, yeah.
Is where we throw things away, the placentas away.
Yeah, and that's also where dying babies go?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning. At that stage, I was a doctor, a mission doctor. I was doing a cesarean sections. I was fixing broken bones. I was dealing with HIV that was just starting. I was doing many different things. And so we started the skin-to-skin contact. And after two or three times, my wife, Jill, you mentioned, and sister Agneta sewed a shirt that kept the baby in a safe position while mother was sleeping.
A shirt, yeah.
Then I did a work on tuberculosis. I published a paper. I did a thesis on scorpion stings. I worked with HIV and AIDS home-based care programs, and I was really busy. And then 6 years later, I said, well, let's look at what happened to those babies that we've been looking after all the time, because they didn't need a lot more looking after. Why? The mother looked after them. Yes, the midwife helped the mother, looked after them. And what we could see when we compared to the old care, which was otherwise identical, only the place had now changed, what had previously been a 10% survival of babies below 1,500 grams was now 50% survival.
50.
So this was an observation.
Yeah.
Where I started.
Yeah. You said the baby was eye-opening, but the observation was also eye-opening then.
Very nicely put.
Yeah.
Very nicely put.
So, how is it going with the eye-opening of the rest of the world ever since?
Now you're jumping ahead.
Yeah, well, you're free to jump back a bit, but I mean, it was amazing to see these 2 days, how still people come and still they feel that there is so much work to do. And at the same time, they feel that somehow this is the direction we should pick, but it's difficult.
So the eye opening, the baby's eye opening turns out when I now start studying why is this happening. And it began really, I had to leave Zimbabwe. And then I could go to Cape Town where I could study public health. And now I had access to a library. I could find articles and I could read them. And I found a set of articles when I started looking at separation. And it was a supplement to Acta Pediatrica, which is a journal about pediatrics and neonates. And this was a supplement where a whole group of biologists had published papers written to neonatologists.
Biologists to neonatologists.
Their research on birth and newborn care of rats and rabbits and mammal, sheep, different things. And they had researched birth and breastfeeding in mammals, and they had a huge amount of insights that we never applied to humans, because maybe humans aren't mammals.
Mm.
No, they are mammals.
For sure.
So there was a huge amount of insights from those publications that wouldn't make sense to a doctor that has a baby in an incubator, but that were eye-opening.
Mm.
For me, I've seen those eyes open in the baby. Now my eyes were open because I could see that this is exactly the mammalian expectation at birth.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, as they say, lungs in a mammal are an expectation of oxygen. And so you saw the expectation in the baby and what the baby expected to be its environment after birth.
And so that environment is mother, mother's body. We had puppies, and their actual environment is the nest.
Mm.
And the nest provides them with their needs. Mother comes and goes and feeds them. But primates, the environment is mother's body.
Mm.
So nevertheless, there's a pattern in the brain across the entire mammalian order, breastfeeding.
Mm.
And this pattern expresses itself in many different ways, but they are common features.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but even before breastfeeding, the actual birth process and the birth behaviors are very, very similar across all species.
Mm.
Then they can diverge. At the very beginning, they're very, very similar.
Of the baby, you mean?
Of the baby and the mother.
Of the mother as well. After birth or before birth already?
At
birth.
During labor.
Yeah.
At the moments of birth.
Yeah.
And in the minutes that follow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I had learned all about neonatology, and I know how a small infant behaves. But only when I read what other mammals do did it make sense with what I had seen in Zimbabwe. Because here were very, very small babies doing something that big babies can't do when they're separated.
Say that again. Small babies do
very small babies will breastfeed when they're in skin-to-skin contact.
Mm.
And you take a baby away from its mother, and it will become cold, and it can't breastfeed, and you disturb it.
Yeah.
But I had seen this on small babies doing skin-to-skin contact. In those days, 35 years ago, we didn't do skin-to-skin like we now do in the first hour, what we should do all the time.
Yeah.
So this was the eye-opening thing, that there was a huge body of science that showed what should happen at birth. And then there was a second huge body of research on primate separation.
Mm.
To be more specific, humans are primates.
Yeah.
But there is a huge body of research on non-human primates.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And it shows that separation is totally catastrophic
for
the neonate.
And what the general public may know about this is the work of Harry Harlow, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Like putting monkeys in cages where the one has a cloth mom and the other has a bottle, and they go for the cloth because they need the comfort.
They need comfort.
Yeah, and the comfort will make them feel safe.
They must feel safe.
Yeah.
So out of this early birth behavior, this separation, perhaps indeed, as you say, the third key eye-opening thing was fundamental importance of being safe, and that requires being in the right place.
Yeah, the right place.
So That is the overriding piece of understanding life and death. Am I safe?
Am I safe?
Everything the brain does after that is determined by the answer to that question.
Yeah, so black and white thinking, actually. Yeah.
That answer is black and white and gray with respect to the magnitude of the response. But if I am unsafe, I switch off breastfeeding. I switch off approaching. I switch off sociality. And I focus only on self and survival.
Preservation, yeah.
This preservation comes in degrees.
Yeah.
But am I safe is only I am safe. And then an entire different physiology is expressed.
Yeah. And
that physiology for those small babies was eye-openingly life-saving.
Hmm. Yeah, the physiology that happens when they feel safe. Yeah.
Which requires being skin-to-skin contact.
Yeah.
Immediately after birth and continuously thereafter.
Yeah. And so you speak about the right place. There's this beautiful quote you always mention. Nothing
an infant cannot do makes sense except in the light of mother's body. From yeah. James McKenna.
Yeah. Very familiar to me as well after his book translations I did. The right place... often we think that we have to be careful with sort of almost ethical judgments about the right, who's to decide what the right place is. And for long, with all the technology coming up, we have probably thought that for tiny babies, the incubator is the right place. And that's where we went off track, you feel?
Yes. Produced a technological solution. But it wasn't actually something that came out of logic or research or science. I've described the development of it and identified it really as an accident of history.
Yeah.
It just happened to be in a context where a discovery was made and it was commercialized. And then mothers were in the way, and then strict separation to keep the babies from getting dying so that, no. So actually, the zero separation is a response then to 100 years of an uncontrolled experiment.
An uncontrolled experiment.
We've experimented for 100 years on our whole population of the world, separating mothers and babies from birth.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the world, I think we should stop the experiment.
Yeah, it's about time. a few thoughts come up because I remember you saying once, long ago when I started listening to your work, it's not the incubator that saves the baby's lives, but the technology that we can apply if the baby really needs it, but that technology can also be applied on mom's body.
So, yes, the incubator can provide humidity. It can provide warmth primarily. But what saves baby's life is surfactant. CPAP. Before that we had oxygen, but then that also made them blind. So we were doing things and then we sort of lived with the side effects of those. And so now, yes, we can have survivors because we throw a whole lot of technology at that baby and we keep the lungs going and the heart beating, but we don't really think about the outcome of what that did to the baby's development, what that did to the baby's brain. And yes, now we know that we have very poor outcomes.
Mm.
We might gloss over them and say, yes, but it's much better than it might have been. And yes, there's a little bit of developmental delay, but maybe we'll catch up. So we've covered up the fact that we've harmed babies by separating them.
Mm. And so still are, because happens a lot.
To this day.
Yeah. Yeah, so we see this whole... issue of medicalization in the whole birth field, of course, and maybe there's a lot more in the perinatal period that we gloss over, but...
So the epidemiological evidence, when you look at data of outcomes and you collect all the babies that were born in a country and you measure it from 1990 to 2010, 2020, it's very clear. Surfactant made a peak, a jump in survival. The use of CPAP made a jump in survival, and the use of antenatal corticosteroids. But the antenatal corticosteroids didn't work unless you had the CPAP. But that's 30 years ago. Now, there's been no change in the survival.
Mm.
But, yes, we can fine-tune the survival and we can fine-tune our equipment so that we get a survival down the ages. 22 weekers, yes, but now the survival is very iffy and the outcome is iffier. Mm. There's even more. So there's ethics there and debate there and... But those are very few, really. We separate mothers and babies routinely everywhere.
Mm.
And we take the developmental outcomes as given. The developmental outcomes are what they are, and we don't question if they could be different. Because they are normal. Normal as in common. Normal as in statistically where the peak of our curve is, but not normal biologically.
Mm.
So going back a few minutes thinking and talking, we were saying normal in terms of biology leads to a development of not surviving. We have a survivor mentality when we provide care. Biology wants not survive, but thrive. We call it reproductive fitness. We call it life history theory, optimal development in a slow life history is what's called. That is the optimal development. We don't even know what that translates to in our culture. But we do know very clearly what it translates to when we look beyond our culture in terms of the underlying science.
Yeah, so what you're saying is it once made a huge difference, certain technologies, but it does not do that anymore. And
it did improve survival, and we can push that survival up and up and up and up.
Little bits.
But at the constant cost of the quality of that
life.
Survival.
Yeah.
We have never budged the quality of that survival.
Yeah, so of course, if people are educated and raised within a certain paradigm of how things should be, they can be emotionally invested, they can be economically invested, they can be career invested in a certain approach. So there's a lot of ways that we can be invested in certain approaches and have difficulty letting go of them and replacing them by something new.
Yes.
I think that's what we heard also in our audiences, right? This morning and yesterday, that they say, yes, but.
So... Winston Churchill said, we make the building, and then the building makes us.
Mm.
We're constrained by our infrastructure. But we also have minds set in stone. And so, yes, the buildings are also internally what we call the construct of thought or paradigm, the assumptions that we have that we don't question. So, yes, and you mentioned earlier that we're proud of this, we defend this. Yeah. So there's a journey in terms of saying, yes, there is an alternative. And how do we come about there? I did think, however, there's another piece of the science, of the biology, that I came to learn later.
Mm.
35 years ago when I started doing this, I could see that it worked and that there was an there was a human being in that tiny little body hiding in those eyes. Mm. Oh, and I couldn't explain why. Since those 35 years, there's been the decade of the brain. We've discovered microbiota. We've discovered epigenetics. We've discovered how the gene works more detailedly and how the brain works. When I first made this observation, those things weren't there.
Mm.
But you also describe
how... You mean
how
which made it harder to explain why happened what happened?
No. You described how the journey began and I made this observation that I couldn't explain. But you also described that there was a journey. Yeah, year by year, a new discovery was made and I could say, ah, tick, that's fit in here. And then another epigenetics, ah, and then the microbiota, ah. So yes, there's been a journey where I've been able to gather and collect the pieces that I can now explain.
Connect
what I
the
saw
dots.
35
yeah.
years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that journey, microbiota is happening, you don't even see it, but it matters hugely. But there's a very key piece of this discovery that wasn't there earlier. And it relates to resilience, which you mentioned at the beginning. And so it begins with, am I safe?
Yeah.
And if I'm safe, I start a whole lot of behaviors. And so I'm safe because I'm in the right place.
Mm.
That right place is the mother's chest. It's not the mother that warms the baby. It's the mother's chest, which is the place where the baby warms itself.
Or regulates or cools down, right?
So that's one part of regulation.
Yeah.
And then that place, there's smell of the breast. And the baby will approach and do a pre-feeding behavior and it will suckle. And it is itself swallowing colostrum that it finds there. And therefore, the baby also picks up the microbiota that it needs and wires the mother's brain to look after it.
Yeah.
A very, very key departure from seeing the baby in the incubator.
Yeah.
The baby has profound competence,
profound
capacity.
Yeah.
It's the baby that's wiring the mother.
Mm.
Now the mother can wire the baby, but they interact.
Yeah.
This competence we totally eliminate when we separate the baby and the mother. That is very fundamental.
Yeah.
Once you've got this behavior, this set of behaviors, this whole umbrella of behaviors, some of that we identify as regulation.
Mm.
The baby is able to control its heart rate. And it's like the mother is in the fridge. I have a thermostat. Mm-hmm. I can change the temperature. And there's a little thermostat temperature, but other stats for heart rate, for metabolism, for breathing, for the liver function. And the mother sets all of those.
Mm.
They can be called clocks.
Mm.
And the mother does not just a regulation of the baby's state now, but the baby's tray, the baby's trajectory in the very early minutes of life.
Yeah.
So this regulation also began with those eyes that opened.
Yeah, yeah.
Why were those eyes that opened such a profound thing on a 30-something-year-old young doctor in the bush who was doing busy, meaningful things? But there was a profound impact when I saw a very, very small baby that had a human being inside the eyes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it turns out that this is actually very much deeper than the 30-year-old young doctor. Turns out that this eye-to-eye contact is just as important as the skin-to-skin contact. And when there's eye-to-eye contact, there is a clear, short pathway between the eye opening because the baby feels safe.
Yeah.
The warmth, the regulation makes the amygdala feel safe, and the emotional brain in the amygdala talks to the social brain in the frontal lobe, and the social brain says, there's somebody there, and you can see that somebody if you open your eyes.
Yeah. And therefore, you can rely on them.
And that, and you can trust.
You can trust.
The capacity to trust.
Yeah.
Turns out is an oxytocin-driven regulation.
Yeah.
The same oxytocin drives the sociality. The same oxytocin drives the future connection to dopamine and to cortisol regulation.
Yeah. Can I stop you there for a moment, Niels? Because for you, it's just so ingrained, all this knowledge. And we spoke about this last few days about conscious and inconscious, unconscious competence and stuff like that. But I remember this saying. I think it was Carlene Gribble when I was in England years ago, where there were, I'm not sure if you were there as well then that time, but Brian Palmer was also there. But I remember they were both speaking about what you just said, how states become traits. And I think this is a very concise summary of how we can understand the importance of the early postnatal period.
Mm.
Because for many people, it's very hard to believe still that what happens in the early days will have such a big effect like 20, 30, 40 years down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, the trust aspect, if states become traits and this first state is one of lack of trust, then that may also become a trait.
Indeed.
And then to realize that, like you say, the baby has profound competence. When you just said that, I felt really moved. And I feel it now. Because that is not how we usually look at babies.
No, it's not. Indeed. But they are like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if you spoke about the Convention on the Rights of the Child this afternoon in your lecture, and I remember looking it up one day as I was sort of writing essays against the Dutch National Sleep Guidelines, who were advocating to let the baby cry it out, where it says in the CRC, babies have a right to the highest attainable standard of health. So that really demands something from us, right?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So if we want to foster and nurture that resilience, well, I say nurture now, probably because I've been hearing the word over the last two days again so often, because you've come up with a new word, right? Can you say a bit more about that?
Nurture science.
Nurture science.
One word.
Yeah, one word. Not neuroscience, nurture science.
Right.
Yeah.
So this emotional connection, the oxytocin that connected to dopamine, that connected to cortisol, is regulation of stress and being safe. But it's just one step from resilience.
Mm.
Because as you say, if this first experience is of, I also use the word buffering, which is another word for loving, which is another word for mothering,
protecting,
which is another word for protecting. The baby's encompassed, skin-to-skin contact, feeling safe. That connects oxytocin and dopamine in a circuit that combines with cortisol that helps the baby manage stress. Only if the stress cortisol circuit is wired to dopamine and oxytocin will there be resilience. Because oxytocin and dopamine together will lower cortisol.
But they have to be in sort of, what would you say, feedback loop or be in touch with one another, so to speak?
So cortisol and dopamine and oxytocin are in a single network. That deals with stress.
Yeah.
That deals first with threat of stress. And then, if I'm safe, I can turn the cortisol off. When I'm unsafe, I turn the cortisol on.
Or higher up, yeah.
I must be able to switch it off.
At a certain point.
Soon, rather soon than later, in a short time. If cortisol stays high, it will switch oxytocin off.
Ah, yeah.
And now we're in a cortisol state, which leads to lifelong effects of development trajectory.
Yeah.
So this is almost the opposite of what I was led to believe when I was a medical student.
Mm-hmm.
Emotion is something that develops later. Animals don't have emotions, is what I was told.
Oh, okay.
And therefore, likely in the human, it develops much later because it's on top of all the mammalian brain, you see. So therefore, emotions are not very interesting.
Mm.
When Panksepp discovers that emotions are fundamental, he has difficulty publishing a book called Affective Emotional Neuroscience, because affective and science are oxymoron, or opposites, or not nurture and science.
Emotions are non-scientific.
Yeah. This was how I grew up. This was how I was brought up as a medical student. And it turns out to be the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Emotions are the platform for resilience. And therefore, feeling safe and having close emotional connection to mother is what resilience is made up of.
Mm.
And the circuit's very short. It's the first circuit that forms after birth. I am regulated. I open my eyes. I fire my amygdala. My amygdala fires to my frontal lobe. My frontal lobe says, approach. What can I approach? I open my eyes and I see another pair of eyes.
Mm.
Those eyes are connected to the same dopamine system, the same oxytocin system, and they regulate each other.
Mm.
It's not the baby that's being regulated. It's baby regulating with mother regulating in synchrony.
Yeah, so there's reciprocity in the system.
Reciprocity, contingency.
Yeah.
Different words are used to say exactly this.
Yeah, so and it's what Dan Siegel calls interpersonal neurobiology. So there's a lot going on between us always.
That is the essence of regulation.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can talk about ecology. We're reductionist when we do a controlled, randomized control trial. We have everything controlled and we compare two pieces. Ecology is the opposite. Nothing is controlled.
Mm.
And it's not one. It's organisms, one, two or three or more, interacting with each other, but determined by the environment that they're in.
Yeah.
Are they safe?
Yeah.
And therefore, this resilience, all the words we've used now, they're all encompassed inside there.
Yeah.
It's the to and fro, the rupture and the repair, the contingent interactions.
Yeah, because there was an interesting question this morning, right, from this one lady who said, you spoke about continuous skin-to-skin contact and how important it is, and then she said, how long should that last? And you made a bit of a joke about it and said, ask the baby. There was a baby in the room, so we were all looking at the baby. But then we did get to that, because I remember that too, that of course there will be a rupture. And as you explained as well this morning, it's the quality of the repair that will be the biggest influence on the quality of the resilience.
Yes. But the quality is not even so important. It's the fact of the repair. You don't want to say to a mother, you must do this repair well.
No, of course.
You want to say, do the repair.
No, yeah, of course, do the repair. But I mean, if I say, if we don't speak for a bit, and then I say, don't complain so much to my child, I mean, that's not really repair, is it?
No.
So we have to speak about what repair looks like then. Yeah, that's what I meant with quality.
You're quite right.
Yeah.
The fact that it's taking place with respect, with dignity, with interaction, with openness, empathy.
Empathy, yeah. In compassionate inquiry, we call this empathetic abiding presence.
Yeah, there you go.
Which is all about attunement and co-regulation indeed. So we were a bit surprised about how there did not come so many questions. We were told that this also had to do with the local culture of people being a bit hesitant about asking questions. I was very curious. I could not imagine that people did not have questions, but maybe it's still a bit overwhelming for people, all this information and how it compares to their daily practice.
Yes. And I'm struggling with this idea, and we have discussed it a little bit here, and after discussing it, I'm still struggling with it. Yeah, no. So I describe for myself a journey of an observation, and then finding a scientific explanation for it, which is totally at odds with the Belgian culture.
Mm.
Yeah, not just the Belgian culture, my Swedish culture. Mm. Well, our global medical culture. Nevertheless, I can present and explain this. And when I first started, this was called pseudoscience.
Oh, pseudoscience.
This was called witchcraft.
Witchcraft.
You're laughing, but this was written in the feedback forms when I did grand rounds.
Oh, no, really?
Yes, really.
Witchcraft?
Yes, because this is totally off the wall. This is
not... This guy has completely lost his mind.
And that was common when I first started in around about 2000.
2000.
Now, when I came to 2010, some microbiota had been discovered. Hey, there's been a decade of the brain. Interesting. Another few years later, hey, there's epigenes. Hey, there's a compelling story. A story, nevertheless, but so compelling.
A regular upgrade, yeah.
So, yes, I do think that there's been a shift, but not in the paradigm as a whole.
Mm.
There's been a shift in acceptance, and okay, but it's a long way from saying, okay, we've got to make this happen.
Yeah.
What can I do in the meantime? Yeah, I hammer harder on my drum.
Yeah.
The same drum that I've been hammering on for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And yes, I'm trying to say things perhaps more wittily, perhaps more succinctly, perhaps more provocatively.
Mm.
And it doesn't change anybody.
Mm.
Your compassionate inquiry will explain to me why it doesn't change anybody.
but
it's still
inquiry,
a process of a shifting.
Yeah. But I remember from learning about paradigm shifts that Thomas Kuhn says, we create shifts until those shifts also no longer explain what is actually going on, and then we have to make a leap. So,
scientific revolutions.
Yeah, exactly.
Thomas Kuhn.
Yeah.
So, now, eventually, suddenly, is published a randomized controlled trial in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the biggest profile medical publication in the world.
Mm.
And it says, do not separate babies.
Mm. When was that?
2021.
21, okay.
4 years ago.
Mm.
And a year later, the World Health Organization makes a policy that says, start skin to skin immediately. Do not put the baby in the incubator.
Mm.
Keep the baby skin to skin continuously.
Yeah.
Another little months later, it says, here is an implementation strategy document. I have a lot more steam power, horsepower, argument power on my drum. So not only is this an observation that has a scientific explanation, we need a scientific rationale, and that's nurture science.
Yeah.
But now there's evidence from randomized controlled trials, more than just the one. And it's very clear when we re-examine our behavior that actually the incubator is not helping babies at all. And yet, it's in our infrastructure, it's in our mindsets. Our minds are set, not in stone, but in incubator. So, this is the shift that must still come.
Yeah.
And I'm very encouraged that the World Health Organization has been able to do its very proper job in terms of scientific rigor and producing an answer that provides strong recommendation with high certainty evidence.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, those are words that the WHO does not put on anything lightly.
Very readily at all, unless there certainly is such evidence.
Yeah, so one of my questions was, you've come a long way, and what feels like the biggest step forward, also to quite an extent based on your work, would you say that this is the most recent big step?
I wish that I would identify it as a step. A step has a small, I'm being a little bit facetious here, a step for me has a small connotation of movement, of action. A step can also mean a kind of processing, progress. But no, I don't feel that there's a step of actually making it happen.
Oh, because a step requires a deliberate action or movement.
So there is in the mindsets a new, but the step to actually making it happen is still not there.
Okay, so what you're saying is there was no escape now because it was all there?
Only now I can beat my drum harder.
Yeah.
I can be more pitched, I can be more provocative. And nobody can gainsay me.
Can
contradict me.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. My science is solid and impeccable. Yeah. My evidence is solid and impeccable. The policy is written. And the more I beat on that drum, the less progress I make somehow. Well, I must beat my drum.
well, we had a beautiful conversation about this. I really liked it because you said, and that was also the title of your talk, we have the
science,
we have the evidence, we have the policy, and what's next?
What now?
So you've been pondering this question.
And that's still the question.
Yeah.
What now?
Yeah, and we pondered this morning or yesterday, I don't even remember, but about what comes first, the mindset, because that's what you were talking about, the mindset, and it's also related to the paradigm. What comes first, the mindset or the science and the evidence? Because I was wondering whether maybe you always had this mindset which led you to doing the research in the science for the evidence and the policy. So
the mindset might have been put in my mind by that little baby that weighed 1,000 grams.
That eye-opening baby, yeah.
But the mindset now has to belong to the medical fraternity, the entire medical infrastructure, the entire medical system.
And even bigger than that, probably, because as long as we don't feel that babies deserve as much respect as adults and also have this right to the highest standard of health, I'm not sure how this should come about.
So my mindset and the mind-opening things that you identified for me earlier in our interview now, that baby was a small human being.
Yeah.
Does have rights, no matter it weighs 1,000 grams. That is a key part of mindset, that such a baby has rights that give obligations. So I've been fulfilling that baby's obligation on me for these last years. Well, it's every baby has that obligation on every one of us. We, every one of us, need to meet this obligation. And so, yes, the processing, this message that I can now share in my Belgian tour of zero separation and now here also in Amsterdam, thank you so much, I'm pleased to do that, But it's also an obligation that we have of shifting the paradigm. Well, what's a simple thing to say? What, we don't know what that really means. But we have an obligation to change.
Yeah.
And I hope, I trust, I pray that these presentations that I make contribute meaningfully to making such change.
Yeah. Yeah, because we were speaking to one of the people present this morning, and she told us about what is going on in her hospital. And it reminded me of how in the field of lactation, we used to say mothers have a right to breastfeed, and how some of us felt like we might change this to babies have a right to be breastfed. Because it's one thing if you acknowledge that women have certain rights, but that babies have certain rights puts an obligation on all of us, because a right implies other people to feel a responsibility.
Obligation.
And an obligation, yes.
So now I need to disagree with you a little bit, you see.
Maybe not, but we'll see.
That small human being does not have a right to be breastfed. That small human being is breastfeeding. It's not being breastfed.
Okay. Oh, we don't disagree. I fully agree. Let me rephrase that. The baby has a right to breastfeed.
Yes, indeed. But you see, we never thought of that because we never thought it.
No.
So this is part of the nurture science and the human right.
Yeah.
That this fundamental capacity, the baby has these profound competencies.
Yeah.
And it's the baby's right to be first,
of
in
course.
The right place.
Yeah, I fully agree, of course, with this correction. But it's interesting how we word it in different languages. Because English we say the mother breastfeeds, and we say the baby breastfeeds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is like in Swedish, but in Dutch we say the mom breastfeeds. And the baby gets breastfeeding. That's how we word it.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So it's not, there's not an active form. We don't say.
And then the key is, for this, the baby must be in the right place.
Yes, of course. But these words that we use in language, as long as we use them in like a passive way, like I just did, the baby has a right to be breastfed, makes it a sort of object that gets something instead of giving autonomy and agency to the baby, which is it's a mind shift in itself, I think.
And when this mind shift sees the baby as competent,
exactly,
then because it's in the right place,
yeah,
the most overriding neural behavior is, am I safe?
Yeah,
I'm in the right place. Now a whole range of behaviors will express themselves. Warming, feeding, protecting are behaviors of the baby. And that requires the basic human right of a baby is to be on his mother's chest.
Yeah.
Continuously from birth.
Yeah, to be in the right place. I translated the book, Hold Your Pram, and it's now called in Dutch, Koester Je Kleintje, Cherish Your Little One. And there's also a lot of work of your wife Jill in that one, in that book, and she really, you both join forces on this topic and on this kind of care, and I did a training last year with you and a lot of other beautiful people, also from Compassionate Inquiry, partly. There's this training, there's this word doula, and you have come up with a new term called Kangaroola.
Kangaroo Mother Care
Doula. Kangaroo Mother Care Doula.
Becomes
shortened to Kangaroola.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, because you also explained today that for some certain forms of care, you don't need to be like academically or extremely highly trained. You have to understand certain principles. You have to be knowledgeable about how to approach it, but there's a lot of ways that you can be supportive to a mom and her baby to make sure that this constant kangaroo mother care can be provided.
And so what I was explaining in that context is that I'm trained as a doctor to deal with disease and pathology. And you can do absolutely the best care possible. And in the IKMC study, that was done to 3,200 babies. Now, half of those babies got that best care possible in incubators, which is the standard of care.
Mm.
And it's not standard as an average, it's the standard as in the best optimal possible.
Mm.
Now, the other group got the same care, but not in an incubator. They were in a different place.
Mm.
See, I'm coming back to this word quite often.
Yeah.
Am I in the right place?
Yeah.
And this was the essence of the immediate kangaroo mother care study. And so what the kangaroo mother care supporters, that was what they called in the study,
mm-hmm.
my wife calls them kangaroola, what they did was nothing to do with maximum possible best care. Because that was done by nurses and doctors and neonatologists and obstetricians and anaesthetists.
Mm.
They, kangaroo mother care supporters, looked after the physiology, which is not medical.
Mm.
They held the babies with their mothers. They helped the mothers express colostrum. They gave it to the babies. The mothers and the babies were not always in the same place. And they gave it to all 3,200 babies. Half the ones that were in skin to skin and the other half. They helped the mother with the practicalities of skin-to-skin contact. Even with all, the doctor was responsible for the CPAP, but the kangaroola would help. And so she had a job description of 10 points, and none of those were medical.
Mm,
they were physiological support.
Yeah.
And so it was ensuring the benefit of the biology, the physiology. The benefit of the biology is what improved the survival.
Mm.
We couldn't increase more evidence-based medicine of care for pathology. But by adding, notice, care that was physiological, we profoundly lowered mortality.
Yeah, so now we are at the topic that you closed your lecture with today. The difference between a salutogenic and a pathogenic approach, where the pathogenic approach is much about, as we used to say, primum non nocere, first do no harm, which is, like you said, and I agree, which is an important thing. Of course, we should not do harm, but there's a difference between not doing harm, which is called, as an ethical principle, non-maleficence, and, on the other hand, actively doing good, as you translated it, the word beneficence. So this whole idea, I've worked with it as well. I love this concept of salutogenesis, because there's many differences between salutogenesis and pathogenesis that are really interesting, because salutogenesis is also prospective, where pathogenesis is much more retrospective. The one is curative. The other is, another word escapes me. There's another word. There's a different word from prevention. It will come back to
promotion.
Me.
Promotion.
No. It's another word. It's a beautiful word. I will get back to it. But also, salutogenesis is very much an approach that comes from what does the client or the patient feel they need to experience health and well-being. So it's client or patient led, whereas pathogenesis is much more about treatment based on what the healthcare provider thinks should happen. So they're fundamentally different. And you are making a plea today for a more salutogenic approach in the care for babies in general, and especially for the prematurely born ones.
And one of the ideas that is presented with salutogenesis is the idea of the second law of thermodynamics.
Oh.
Where did that come from? It comes from the fact that if you do nothing, you revert to a state of entropy. Mm. So if you do nothing, you go backwards. If you in the middle of a river and you stop swimming,
yeah.
the river will take you downstream.
Yeah.
Salutogenesis, therefore, requires active steps. It's not an automatic default position.
No, another defense and prevention. But
pathogenesis assumes that if I've treated your disease, you're fine now.
Yeah.
No, you've got to actively keep your health moving forwards.
Yeah.
Because you're in a river, and that river is taking you downstream.
You need
the
to
second
learn to
law
swim.
Of thermodynamics is taking you downstream, and you must swim.
So you must
actively.
Learn to swim. Yeah.
Well, it's a little bit of stretching the analogy. Yeah, but the second law of thermodynamics says if you do nothing, you go backwards. You revert to a state of nothingness.
Well, it's interesting because the father of salutogenesis, Antonovsky, he says the whole idea with the pathological approach is that we assume that people are born perfect and will stay that way, but they can deteriorate if illness happens. And he says it's the other way around. We are flawed in the sense that we know we will all die. And the question is, how can we postpone that, so to speak, by actively doing good and actively looking for what is it I can do to keep up this
health? So what I'm saying is exactly that,
yeah.
just using an analogy.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's, I think it's a beautiful idea because it's somehow counterintuitive if you think of salutogenesis and say, yeah, well, we're all flawed. That sounds as if you think that we are ill from the beginning, but it's the other way around.
We're not actually flawed.
No.
We know how to swim, but we have to swim because we're in a river.
Well, I will tell you, it takes a lot of time for most Dutch parents to make sure that their children learn how to swim.
Well, so, they've got to swim.
Yeah.
Well, it's not necessarily swimming in water. It's in the river of life.
Yeah, the river of life, exactly. So, but I think salutogenesis is a beautiful approach that has a much more optimistic lookout. And it's also invigorating in the sense that it invites you to ask yourself, what is it that makes me happy? Or what is it that I really get passionate about? I told you again these days that I remember when we were in Durham that I asked you, this is a topic I would really like to dive into. So what kind of study direction you think I might choose? And you looked at me, you looked me in the eyes, I looked you in the eyes, and it was eye-opening for me to get back to that. And you said, it doesn't really matter. It's all about the fire in your gut. And I think we saw that today with some people as well who say, like this lady we spoke to, she said, I had a baby who had serious issues at birth. And we made it through, and this is what motivates me to do this work. So how is that for you? Because you've been doing this for a long time now, and we spoke about whether you will, as we say in Dutch, die in your harness, like continue doing this. What's left for you where you say, that is where I want to make a difference still?
30 years ago, I thought, naively, that when that publication came in the New England Journal of Medicine, that I could tick the box. And then the month after the study closed recruitment, the pandemic came. The world suddenly stopped. And so did my speaking and my working.
Yeah, yeah.
That was perfect because my father was dying. He'd died full of years, but we looked after him at home. He didn't go to an old age home like the society expected. Mm. We kept him at home, and it was good. And then my family. So I had focus on family. I have 6 grandchildren. Yes. If anybody phones and says, would you mind? I've already left by the time they finish talking, fetching the child from preschool or whatever it is.
Okay.
Now there's a difference in the world. You identified that I'm a grandfather, yeah.
Yeah.
But now they're all a bit bigger and they're all coping nicely and nothing has happened to that publication that I thought was going to be...
going to change the world.
It hasn't.
Yeah, it hasn't.
It hasn't. So this is the question that you're asking me. Yeah. What now? And we've been discussing as we've been together these last 2 days. And I haven't given you a good answer. No. Well, it's been good to think about the answer. But I am feeling that, no, if God gives me more years and as much energy as you have, yes, I will continue.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think there is still a lot to be learned for many people in this field. And you said to everyone, I will send you the PDF with the slides. I think it were about 250 again or something. I don't know. So it's a long PDF. I think we can study on that PDF for at least a week and still have a lot of questions.
350 slides.
Yeah. Oh, 350. Oh, I was off 100 slides. Yeah. So it's always difficult how to get the message across so that people take something with them from that. And we spoke about how sometimes one sentence or one word can make a difference. And for you, it was that one eye-opening moment with that baby that made a difference. What do you think people need most to change their practice in their own settings, in their hospitals or neonatal wards or maternity care or wherever we take care of babies and little children? What is it they need to get most to understand?
So we mentioned earlier the mind shift.
Mm.
But there are also more pragmatic, practical things. So in this documents that came from the World Health Organization, there's a global position paper that says what I've been sharing with you here now. But there's also an implementation strategy. So the World Health Organization has spent 2 years working up an answer to your question.
Mm.
Yeah, read it. Yeah, well, it doesn't quite work just to read something. But there's some value in there, some good value. And perhaps very briefly, as many pieces, but one of them is health systems are made up of 6 building blocks. WHO calls them that. 6 dimensions, 6 aspects, 6 components. And to make this change...
Can you name them? Can you mention the 6 ones? Or,
yeah? You think I can remember?
I think so.
I'm coming to them.
Yeah. Okay.
So what you then have to do with change is to address all 6 at the same time.
Mm.
And the very first, the top one, is leadership and governance.
Mm.
And you have to be able to have leadership that sees the big picture and enables that the other 5 components, the building blocks, get addressed and dealt with.
Mm.
The second building block is financing.
Mm.
The third building block is human resource. Then you need service delivery, actual policies. You need equipment, supplies, and you need IT, information systems. Because otherwise, the person at the top doesn't know what happened to his decisions. I put it at the end, but it can be put in the middle. So you get the feedback loop, your PDSA cycle, plan, develop, serve, act. So your quality improvement cycle says you do this, and then you see what happens, and then you measure, and you see, did I do that?
Mm.
No, why not? And then you do it again.
Like again. Yeah.
So that's kind of embedded in this thought process. So you now have to actually ensure that every one of those building blocks is addressed not as a step, but it becomes a leap. You have to do all six at the same time.
Mm.
Now, this leadership is not the CEO.
Mm.
It includes the CEO and the Minister of Health.
Mm.
But it also includes every one of the people sitting in that room. And usually in a room, there will be 1 out of 10, 1 out of 20, who is actually, we might call a champion.
Mm.
That is a safe word to call a person, but it's also another name for a leader.
Mm. Mm.
The champion from within the ranks who leads. Champions is then identified as one of the, and I'm advocating for making that champion dedicated to the task of doing good, physiology, for example. So here's a picture. Yes, you don't make a step here and there. You need leadership. You need somebody that can say, here's a little bit of money that you can use to start that. You need somebody to say, okay, human resource, here's one person that you can use, dedicated to the task. And then the IT will measure, and then you have the protocol. You just take it straight from the Ministry of the World Health Organization, and they sent it to your Ministry of Health. In Belgium, they have 8 ministries of health. Every one of them should have got a copy, but they'd probably have forgotten. So here in Netherlands, maybe it's not so difficult.
Yeah.
And now I come to the last one. Me and my colleagues have been saying in our zero separation tour of Belgium, I ask only one thing of you, and that is put an adult bed in your NICU.
Mm.
Just one.
Mm.
And not a bed from the hotel, a hospital bed. And they all say to me, we don't have space. I have visited all of them. They do have space.
In the ward, but maybe not in their head.
So this is the expression, if you have heart space, you will have arse space. If you have room in your heart, you will make room for somebody to sit on their bum.
Mm.
That's a Swedish expression that I'm now translating for you. And yes, it's room in your mind.
Mm.
So the mindset is, allow yourself just to put one bed and put one mother and one baby on that mother. And see how that mother feels. Look at how that baby behaves. Look at how that baby feels health-wise. And then also look at the mothers next door that are looking at that mother and baby.
And they also want a bed.
Shh. But yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put one bed in the NICU. That's
as a starting point.
That would be a good starting point.
An infectious starting point. Yeah.
It is a flag that says, look here, we've started.
Something's happening. Something's changing.
Now, when you've got a nice mother in there tomorrow and the baby is there, call the CEO in.
Mm-hmm.
Call the nursing manager in. I want to show you something.
I want to show you something.
Okay, so now I'm giving very, very practical, direct advice. Here is a way that you can harness the eye-opening of the baby and the mother that are there, but of others who will come and see.
Yeah, yeah.
And of other mothers who will see.
Yeah.
And you will create a kind of momentum.
Yeah. Yeah. But that probably requires, within the system as it is, courage from one or two or three of those in that leadership position.
It requires leadership. Leadership.
Yeah. Okay.
Embedded in that is courage.
It's courage, You know, because
a leader is the champion. The leader is the one who stands up and count on me.
So what you're saying is without courage, there is no leadership.
There must be. You're correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Courage.
Yeah. I remember Brené Brown, she has these beautiful talks about courage and also says something like, I don't have it literally now, but courage is when you cannot control the outcome, but you try it anyway. And she also says that courage without fear is non-existent.
Correct.
Because if there is no fear, then you can also not call it courage. The essence of courage is the fear that it might not succeed, or that you might have to get out of your comfort zone.
And doing the right thing anyway.
Anyway, exactly, exactly.
Indeed.
Yeah, beautiful. I'm still pondering a bit about that one word in Salutogenesis, Genesis, and I still haven't come up with it, but maybe I found it. I find it probably after we close the microphones. I have three little last questions for you, Niels, that I ask every guest. You mentioned one thing, but if you still have a bucket list, what is presently at number one of that bucket list?
In terms of my work?
Well, whatever.
I wouldn't call it a bucket list. I would call it more like a dream. Mm. My bucket lists are some places I'd like to do, and the fish I'd like to catch.
Well, fair enough.
But in the bigger picture, I do have a dream. Mm. I do have that original dream that this is babies, right? The baby's a small human being. And I would still dream that what I naively thought would happen when the article was published, that people would believe it and do it.
Mm.
And that's not happening. Mm. So, yeah. What's on my bucket list? But I have a dream, and I've been chasing it for a long time, and I kind of stopped chasing it because I thought it would happen. But now, my bucket list maybe is continue chasing.
Mm. Continue chasing that dream.
I am feeling that the need to pick up the beating on the drum.
Mm. Good. Another one is, what gives you hope?
I get a lot of hope from beautiful people.
Mm.
You, Michelle, Leticia, people we meet today who clearly show such courage. I get a lot of hope from my grandchildren and my own children.
Who were all born in a very boring way, you told me. Like, we spoke about how eventful or uneventful birth can be.
It was physiological.
Yeah.
There was no pathology.
No pathology.
That's
beautiful.
And and so when I'm feeling depressed, one of my answers to people and myself is, look back 5 years.
Hmm.
Where was the world? Look back 10 years, where were we? It's easier to do than to look forward 5 years. We have no idea.
No.
But it can be some kind of spinal strengthening that straighten your back. Look backwards. Hey, we have come forward a long way.
Mm.
5 years, 10 years, where were we 10 years ago?
Mm.
Yes. So, yeah, stop, reflect, look back. Okay, we can move on.
Mm. And the last one, maybe it's sort of embedded in what you've told so far, but what is something that you are very enthusiastic about right now, something you're working on or something you will dedicate more time to, or again, whatever, work or private or...
Right now, I'm doing a lot of very practical work in my garden. I'm doing carpentry, I've been laying drainage, I've been painting, and that gives me kind of clear the air. My mind can be free.
Mm.
But it's not a reason for being alive. Mm. It's not a purpose.
Mm.
The family again. Mm. But deep underneath, I am then still feeling, so what I'm actually doing that when I can get to it. It requires a huge amount of energy and synapses and processes. This book that you mentioned, I am updating it. My wife actually wrote that book. I had to correct the, not the English, because she's an English teacher. She had to correct my English. I had to do a little bit of ensuring that what she was actively doing also matched the best clinical practices and that it could be.
And,
it's still a very provocative book then. Now the reality is twice as provocative. And in 15 years, a huge amount of new material information has happened. And so, yes, this is the primary purpose, objective that I now have. Hopefully just in the next few months. You know, it doesn't take so short, quick. So yes, it must happen properly. I want to update the book that you called Hold Your Prem. The new edition is going to be called Hold Your Baby. With Prem is passed. So this book will be called Hold Your Baby, a manual for mothers and other caregivers of small and sick babies.
So and of small and sick babies still, because I remember saying then when I was translating, like, this is such important stuff. You mean, I mean, when you say witchcraft like fuzzy stuff, this is not fuzzy, you know, this is hardcore science. You've proven that. And that's why it's in the policy, the WHO right now. So it's science, but it's also applicable to non-sick babies, to healthy babies.
Indeed. And so you don't need a whole manual for full-term babies. And we have thought through that. And therefore, Hold Your Baby
already is very different, that's true.
Covers them.
Yeah.
But now the manual is more detailed because of the small and sick babies. And indeed, we say this in the introduction, and at the end we have a separate chapter where we say, how does this apply to... Because there's a whole lot of complexity, important detail with respect to the small baby. Now you add a baby that just being small is not a sickness. Small means I have to support your physiology. Sick means I have to deal with your pathology that you also might have. Being small isn't pathological. It means physiological extra support. But you might get an infection. But you might have been born small because you were born with an infection. You might have been born small because your mother had an infection. You might have been born small, actually without a disease because your mother. But you might have had a, not a disease, but a placenta. So yes, there will be some pathology. And that's why neonatologists are trained as medical doctors. So they have to read this book because in it, I introduce physiology to them. So that the mother and the other caregivers know the good that must happen. Now, there'll be a separate section at the end of each chapter where, this can also go wrong. But the fear that it might go wrong, you don't say, do nothing. You say, what can I do about the possibility? And when the possibility is actually a fact, what can I do about it without sabotaging my physiology? Without separation.
So the physiology is still primal.
The physiology comes first.
Beautiful. I'm really looking forward, and I hope I can contribute to that book again, because it was a beautiful, like I said, it was a beautiful journey to work on the other one. And
I'm feeling very excited about it. At the same time, there's also the life and the grandchildren that
that I have as well.
And so by God's grace, it'll happen.
Yeah. Well, I was actually joking to our youngest daughter because she's 41 weeks and 4 days pregnant today. And I said to her, I'm going to be on the road with Niels Bergman. And fortunately, your baby has not listened to him about how prematurity works. But at the same time, we are all very curious and eager to receive that little one. And it's always a journey again. Even if the birth is boring, as you said, it can also be uneventful. But all these babies need our care. So it was a joy to listen to you again these 2 days and to hear you advocate for those little ones, because there's so much we can do for them. And if we know how much these early days matter, we also know that we have a huge influence on their life trajectory. So that's beautiful. So thank you for your work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Maria.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. This was an episode of the Raising Resilience podcast by ASO-RNL. We hope it gave you inspiration to raise resilience within your own environment and target groups. And maybe you already do that in a special way. In that case, we would love to hear from you and have you as a guest in our podcast. If you enjoyed it, we hope to see you back and see you share the podcast in order to support ASO-RNL's goal, which is increasing awareness around ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. You too have talents to make the world a bit more beautiful and to contribute to awesome childhood experiences. A secure childhood with buffering protection against stress is the basis of a healthy and just society. If you want to read more about that, you can dive into our blog series on www.aceaware.nl. There you can find impressive stories from experienced experts and professionals and book reviews for more theoretical background. For a training or a discovery journey in a consultation, you are welcome to get in touch for an appointment. To stay tuned, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or through our website. We wish you a beautiful day and hope you keep raising resilience.